Jay Powell today at the IMF. When is the Fed going to taper? More importantly, when the easy inflation comps are over, what then? And what does that mean for stocks? To break that down, I have Peter Buchvar, CIO of Bleakley Advisory Group and editor of The Book Report. Peter, always a pleasure to talk to you. You know, I was just telling you before you came on how pumped up I am. I'm like a viewer in that every 2 weeks I get the chance to talk to you, pick your brain. And so I'm really interested in what you have to say.
I enjoy our conversations.
Let me tell you that one of the reasons I want to pick your brain is as I read your newsletter, The Book Report. I don't know how familiar other people are with that and where maybe you can give a little plug as to where they can find that.
The website's B-O-O-C-K report, so apply my last name. Some people can trial it. They can subscribe and just hear my read my daily missives on the macro economy and markets.
Yeah, and so, you know, I think they're great because, you know, you talk about the numbers, what's happening in the economy, relatively unfiltered, I would say. So, you know, today the number that I was looking at that I wanted to pick your brain on was the jobless claims number. And as you know, this particular period, this particular recession, we've had numbers that actually in aggregate, you know, every week, week after week, almost every single week, except one, maybe 2 weeks recently, have been higher than the highest number ever in this entire series going back to 1967. So we went down last week below that level. And here we are back again at 744,000, which was much more than expected. What are you thinking about these numbers? I mean, why is it that we're still at 744,000 initial claims now, a year into this? And what does it mean for the economy going forward?
Well, it is a little confounding because you have to look at, so that's obviously measuring the pace of firings and then obviously the continuing stuff for how long people are receiving them. What's difficult to sort of square up is that, now this is somewhat dated, but we got a couple of days ago the job openings number for February. Now, of course, claims is you know, through the last week, but through February, we're up to 7.4 million job openings. And not only is that above where we were in February 2020, but you have to go back to 2019, the last time we had that many job openings. So how do you square that many job openings with still a very high level of firings? Now, I can better explain why the number of people receiving continuing claims is still very high between regular continuing claims, which in its reporting is delayed by a week, and then those still receiving continually pandemic assistance and the emergency assistance. If you add up those three, you're talking about 17 million people that are still receiving benefits of some sort. For context, in January, in the heart of the winter, it was about 16.4. So here we are with the vaccines getting rolled out, with job openings very high, you still have a very high level of those still receiving continuing claims. And you just have to ask the question, is whether the enhanced unemployment benefits and the added $300 a week is causing an issue. And I directly know that it is. I was on the phone earlier today with a friend who runs a local swim school that I'm involved in and have invested in, where he's complaining to me about the difficulty of finding people. Now, he's hiring kids in high school, kids in college, and in their young early 20s, and he's having difficulty finding people, more so now than when the unemployment rate was at 3.5% pre-COVID. And you just have to wonder if it is because of the competition with those benefits. And, you know, in one ear I hear, well, people don't respond to that, they want to go back to work. Yeah, many people do. But for others, if it means waiting till September, because that's when these benefits go until, maybe they will, or maybe they'll just take their time in finding work, or they just feel less urgency. But it is going to be a factor in how quickly businesses can ramp up if they can't find the people. And no question, there's also skills mismatch between the job openings and the pool of available labor. There's also, of course, the issue with kids that are still at home for school where you need one parent to be home. So there are other factors here, but this is a growing issue and I think a problem. And that's why I think the participation rate is going to remain low, even with this recovery. And it's why I think that wages are going to surprise to the upside, because companies are going to have to pay more to entice these people or some people to come back to work.
Right. Yeah, I think that's a good point in terms of the inflationary impacts, or at least the positive impacts, if you will, for earnings. You know, when you mentioned September as a time frame, the first thing that came to mind for me, honestly, was they're waiting until, you know, the majority of people are vaccinated. And the reason I'm thinking that is, you know, I got the first shot of the Pfizer vaccine today. Really, you know, the vaccination in America is going so well now that it's just a matter of time before we open up without any real concerns about spikes in coronavirus cases. And so at that point, we're going to see whether or not, you know, what the economy looks like. You know, when I think about these numbers, I think to a certain degree that even once we open up, there's going to be some residual change, you know, in terms of small businesses, in terms of places that you have close contacts like restaurants, travel, et cetera. And perhaps some of the jobless claims are associated with this change that we're going through, that we're still churning through, trying to figure out what the new normal is.
I agree. A lot of people that were hired or employed pre-COVID in leisure and hospitality, well, they found other work. I read an article in the Wall Street Journal a couple weeks ago, and they talked about concerts that are trying to restock their employees for, you know, hopefully late summer into the fall, and hiring roadies and stage people and so on. Well, when you shut down the concert business, a lot of these people found other work, and they're staying in that other work, and they're not coming back. So they're having difficulty finding people. So there's no question that there's going to be friction here in sort of normalizing, both in terms of businesses coming back, because there are many in that sector that are not going to come back, unfortunately, but also bringing back your same people. And you're not going to bring back all of your same people. You're going to have to bring back some of them and find the others elsewhere.
Yeah. And, you know, before we transition to the market side of things today, I want to say that I was looking at Jamie Dimon, what he had to say. A lot of people are talking about this, that the chairman and CEO of JP Morgan Chase came out saying, hey, you know, not only I'm not talking about how long this economy is going to be in recovery and an upcycle, but the boom portion of this economy, that is, you know, this pent up demand portion where we have really high GDP growth, is going to last potentially through 2022. So he's talking about boom times for another year and a half going forward. First of all, do you think that that's actually true? And if so, what does that mean?
Well, I'm confident that we'll have a boom in the next three quarters. I think the problem with analyzing 2022 is that a lot of the fiscal spending that has occurred expires this year. There's not that same ramp up. Now, there's the hope that you pass the baton onto the private sector and you hire a lot of people back and the economy sort of runs on its own. But there is a fiscal hangover that takes place next year. And we'll see to what extent how impactful that is. Also, you're not just going to get a boom in interest rates, even notwithstanding this rise, they're just going to still sit there. We're going to see, I believe, another leg higher in interest rates. I think come late summer into the fall, you're going to start hearing the Fed talking about tapering. You even heard from a few European Central Bank members this week that talked about the possibility of them tapering in the fall. So imagine the interest rate scenario around the world if the Fed and the ECB are contemplating or even following through on tapering, and then you get a fiscal cliff next year. I think it's way too early to think that the boom will continue in 2023 if you see those happening, because that means higher interest rates, a taper, lower stock prices, fiscal cliff next year, which we'll see how that sort of reverses the rise in rates. But I'm not comfortable going out that far. I'm comfortable saying the next three quarters will be very good and not looking past that.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PIE, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know ya at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecast.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Yeah, and you know, when you talk about rates being a big key toggle there, I would agree with you. And you know, that's how I'm thinking about things right now. Maybe that's my bias, but I think that really nothing's going on right now in the market. So that's how I would put it in terms of, you know, we had this huge run up in interest rates, the worst quarter since 1980 for Treasury bonds. But then when you look at today, we've sort of slid back from the 175 level. I think if I look at the 10-year U.S. Treasury, it's trading actually below 163. It's at 162.3 on my screen. And, you know, that's very positive for technology stocks, stocks that have, you know, DCFs with the terminal value, very important. You look at the NASDAQ up 1%, S&P up less, the Dow up even less. Is that the sort of, what are the dynamics that are underneath all of that? How are rates affecting not just the economy and bonds, but also equities?
Well, we've had this just very rotational type market. It's been buy tech, sell everything else, like in 2020. And then it was sell tech, buy everything else for a large part of this year. And then, you know, you tell me where the 10-year is in the morning, I'll tell you where the NASDAQ futures are going to be. And vice versa with the S&P or the Russell. So it's just this constant rotation. But with respect to rates, I mean, we've gone from 90 basis points to 175, 177, and have backed off to 162. You know, the market still has essentially raised interest rates three times this year, three quarter point moves in the long end. So I think we need to have perspective here with the markets, you know, ripping to new highs. I think that, you know, there's I understand that the simplicity sometimes of thought is that, oh, the economy's getting better, buy stocks. The economy is doing bad, sell stocks. Well, if any market veteran knows that there's it's not that easy, because you know, it just, things just aren't that easy. And a lot of the interplay is related to rates and monetary policy and so on. So 2020, everyone celebrated low rates and celebrated what the Fed was doing. And but now with rates rising, you know, I've heard this many times going back to the 90s. Oh, it's okay that rates are rising because it's rising for good reason.
Right.
You know, when you have such interplay and sensitivity between stocks and interest rates and the economy and interest rates and the economy and stocks, it's rates rise for good reason until it no longer is good reason and things start to break. And we will head and we are going in that direction. We just haven't hit that yet. And now maybe we did temporarily at 177 in the 10-year. And now we've obviously, people are breathing a sigh of relief that we've backed off. But to me, this is just temporary. We priced in the easy comp inflation reads that we're going to see over the next couple of months. And that's why the 10-year is probably going to stay contained here in a range of, call it maybe 1.5, 1.75. But come June, July, August, when I believe that the inflation stats will still be printing 0.3, 0.4 a month, proving that the rise is not transitory, well, that'll be the setup for another leg higher in rates. But again, that's not going to be for a couple of months.
Yeah, but I mean, I think that makes a lot of sense.
In the short term, stocks will transition to focusing on earnings, and at least those companies that are in the manufacturing space will see to what extent they're sensitive to, you know, the whole supply chain upheaval and rising cost pressures and the inability to get parts and having to pay for transportation and the what that's going to do to profit margins. I mean, we saw in the Nikkei Asia newspaper that Apple's having difficulty making enough Macs and iPads because they can't get enough parts. So that has an impact on earnings, which the stock market doesn't think it will. But I think you're going to hear more about that in the coming month.
You know, when you talk about impacts on earnings, immediately, you know, I was going to go in another direction, but I immediately think of what I would call the corporate tax grab. Okay, because basically, this is what's happening with the headlines. We know that the Biden administration is now receptive to the concept of a global minimum tax to stop tax avoidance by large multinationals. To me, what this means basically is that if you're Google, you know, if you're Pfizer, you know, you can't domicile in the Netherlands or in Ireland or wherever it might be and think that you can avoid tax. There's going to be a minimum level. And so when we talk about a hit to earnings, there's the potential that we're in a situation where there's a paradigm shift in terms of how governments are thinking. They're thinking, we want to spend money in order to boost the economy, and we're not going to just deficit spend. We're actually going to make sure that there's tax revenue to deal with that spending, and we're going to get it from somewhere, and that somewhere has to be the corporates. That seems like where we're going, both in the United States and elsewhere in Europe and the developed world. Do you think that that's actually where we're headed? And if so, what impact will that have on earnings?
Yeah, we're back to the same old tax and spend philosophy. We know where that got us last time. I mean, people have to understand that the multiplier effect of government spending is typically below one. So you get less for every dollar in return that you spend. So therefore, that's the basis for the debate about keeping that money in the private sector or handing it over to government. Here's an example. So for those that live in New York, the Tappan Zee Bridge, they knocked it down and they built the Mario Cuomo Bridge. This bridge has cost $3.8 billion for a 3-mile bridge. And the contractors are suing the state of New York for another $800 million because of cost overruns that they are not reimbursed for. So let's just say it cost them, the New York State, $4.5 billion, okay? $4.5 billion for a 3-mile bridge where they could have taken a fraction of that money and every year for the last 30 years focused on maintenance and fixing things that broke. I mean, people that live in a house, you don't knock it down every 10, 15 years because, you know, things break. You hire somebody to fix it. So I'm giving this example to point out the inefficiencies of government spending when you hear about infrastructure. So the Obama trillion-dollar so-called stimulus plan back in 2009, when things were shovel-ready, I live in New Jersey. There's a road called South Orange Avenue, and I would go down it every day to take the train into the city. And this road, which is many miles, fell under this American recovery and so on. I forgot the rest of what they called it. And the road was repaved. And then 2 years later, it needed to be repaved again. That's not much return on your money. Cities and states are repaving roads every day anyway. So again, I'm bringing this up to point out the high inefficiency of a lot of this government spending. I'm not saying we don't spend it. I'm just saying that there are ways of doing this in a much more efficient way through maintenance rather than brand new construction. And you let's look at airports. You cannot.
Wait, by the way, you are forgetting one thing, that with the Tappan Zee Bridge, it's probably worth at least $1 billion, that it's called the Mario Cuomo Bridge now. So you got that part of it there.
Well, yeah, it costs it'll end up costing $4.5 billion for the Mario Cuomo Bridge, where it would have cost a fraction of that if you spread out maintenance and fixed it over the past bunch of years. Just as, again, you're not knocking down your house every 10 years because you need a new roof. You just replace the roof. So airports, you can't go buy a stock in a U.S. airport. You can't. Ironically, the privatized airports or partially privatized airports are all outside the U.S. So when you hear a politician comparing U.S. infrastructure versus overseas, well, yes, the U.S. has some privatized toll roads and you can buy stock in companies that manage it. But it's outside the U.S. that has most of the privatized toll roads. You can buy stock in countless international airports, Sydney Airport, Zurich Airport, Vienna Airport, the Frankfurt Airport, Heathrow, Beijing Airport, Shanghai Airport. You can buy airports in Brazil, privatized airports. You can buy stock in Mexican airports. Well, when you have a profit motive, these airports tend to be much more modernized and a lot nicer than many of the airports that we have in the U.S. But you won't have any conversation whatsoever on the concept of maybe privatizing some U.S. airports. It's just I can send in more money.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 is declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Very interesting. But, you know, it is that is where we're headed. Is we are headed, it seems to me, toward a situation where, you know, at least to jumpstart the economy. The real question is how long is this period going to go on, and how much is it going to impact corporations? Because, you know, if there's a tax grab to be had, you know, given populism, I don't think that the middle and the working classes are going to bear the brunt of that.
Well, to the concept of Janet Yellen writing an editorial in the Wall Street Journal today and going around talking about a minimum corporate tax, you really think Ireland, which lowered their corporate tax rate to 12.5% to lure business, is going to say, sure, Janet, we'll raise that up to 25% just as you want it? No freaking way. It's complete nonsense. It's our way of trying to, I mean, so this is our idea of competition. Raise our tax and hope everyone joins us, rather than keeping our taxes low and better competing against everybody else. It's completely backwards.
Well, let me ask you, I have two other issues that are market related that I'm thinking about. One is margin debt. I think I sent you a thing from the Wall Street Journal about, you look at three different periods that are comparable. One today, in terms of the amount of margin debt increase that we've had vis-a-vis the previous year. And the other two periods that are comparable are 2007 and 1999. And we know that both of those periods preceded very difficult times in the market. Are you concerned at all as you think of, yes, the economy is booming, but wait a minute, hold on. Are you concerned that this margin debt is sort of fodder for potential market correction?
So it's important to look at margin debt, not in itself, because it's just an absolute dollar number, but looking at it compared to the market cap of the stock market, or looking at it relative to GDP. Relative to GDP, yes, it's at a record high. But you can draw a chart with margin debt overlaying the S&P, and they pretty much follow each other. But yeah, that will be a problem, and it will matter when it does. Obviously, it mattered for that hedge fund of the last couple weeks that owned Viacom and Discovery and others, where they got obviously way over their skis. So yeah, it'll matter when it does. It helps to exaggerate the move to the upside, and it'll exaggerate the move to the downside. Just the question of what the trigger points are for a change. But I mean, that's what you get when there's another search for yield and money's cheap and people ride the momentum, and this is what you get. I mean, the central bankers are the bartenders behind the bar and gets everyone drunk, and some people can make it home safe, and other people can't, and they get themselves into an accident.
Yeah, and you know, a lot of people are talking about this now. I think Scott Minard, he's talking about this. I see some other bond investors who are talking about the VIX, the low volatility that we have right now, and that even though we're about to go into a potential boom, that the level, the increase in this speculative nature, SPACs as an example, that's all telling you that we're in a frenzied sort of market environment. What are your thoughts about the potential for a correction, even though we're about to go into a potential boom?
Well, look at the S&P is 20% above where it was in February 2020. We've already priced in a lot of good news. We've already priced in the 2022 earnings recovery, because earnings in 2020 are not going to be that much higher than where they were in 2019. So some context and perspective here, I think is important of where the market is today relative to where it was before anybody knew what COVID was.
So as the sort of last thing to say, what do you do in that case? I mean, asset allocation wise, what we're talking about an economy where interest rates may be taking a pause, where we could see a higher inflation numbers 2 or 3 months from now. And we've already baked in a lot of the gains in the equity market. How does one position oneself in that environment?
I think from a trading / investing standpoint with stocks, in my opinion, people have two choices to be successful right now. This is a great, when you see a rotational market like this, it's a great trading market. So for short-term traders, I think this is a good environment. I think I'm more of a long-term investor, which allows me to, focus on the day-to-day, talk the macro day-to-day, but having longer term themes that helps me block out a lot of the short term rotational noise. I think if your trading style is anywhere in between, this is a difficult market. It's like it's a maddening market. So I would stay on a sort of either side of that as having a very short term time horizon or having much longer time horizon, again, because everything in between, we're churning to such an extent, notwithstanding the headline indices. Because underneath, advanced decline line topped out already. Underneath, there's a lot more chop, and I expect that chop to continue, notwithstanding the possibility of a correction here and there. I mean, you look at the sentiment numbers this week. You have in the AAII numbers today, you have bulls at the highest level since the first week of January. A few weeks before the Volmageddon blow up happened, you have bears at the lowest since 2019. In the investors' intelligence numbers, we saw Wednesday, it's bulls back above 60, which I consider extreme. Its spread to bears is now back above 40, with bears in the 16 range. You look at daily sentiment index, you look at the relative strength index. I know you had Tom Thornton on yesterday, talked about the DeMarcs, the VIX at 17. You have daily sentiment index and the VIX very low. So you are set up for a pullback here with all these different things. I just don't know if it happens tomorrow or it happens in 2 weeks.
And you, as someone who is long-term bullish, at least for the next three quarters, is that a pullback that you buy the dip on, or is it something that you think still, 10% down, we're still actually 10% above where we were in February 2020?
Well, I'm bullish on the economy the next three quarters. My concern is that inflation and interest rates are going to surprise to the upside, which then you transition to the possibility of taper talk late summer, And that's going to create a real difficulty for equities, I believe, irrespective of the underlying economy. So yeah, I'm bullish on the economy. I'm much more suspect on markets here for those reasons stated. That said, I'm still long. I'm still but long focused more on precious metals and energy stocks and agriculture stocks and uranium and international markets that I think are cheaper and much more attractive and have a better secular stories than, you know, many overvalued U.S. stocks. And I'm in value stocks. So I'm sort of sticking with my allocation in those areas, at the same time owning some tips and having some cash as dry powder, but knowing that this is not going to be an easy ride, because, you know, as I've said with you before, I really believe that we have entered into a new interest rate regime, even though, again, rates are still low on an absolute level. I get it. But the rate of change is something worth of note, and that we're potentially in a new inflation regime, not high inflation, but higher inflation. I mean, we have to understand that the bond market now, if yields were 2.5-3% in the 10-year, that is a level of rates that can better absorb any readings of inflation that's persistently 2.5-3.5%. But because rates are so low around the world, we're not positioned for any upside surprises in inflation. We're not positioned for 2.5-3%, where looking back 30 years, we would have loved 2.5-3% inflation, you know, considering where we came from in the late 70s. So you combine higher inflation possibilities with extraordinarily low interest rates. That's just not a good combination. And a market that's trading at 23 times this year, 20 times 2022, you know, there's no room for error.
Yeah, well said, Peter. So I hate to leave it on that sour note, but it makes a lot of sense. Buyer beware.
I think I like to say that when you, as you tell a kid, just be aware of your surroundings when they're going out at night. Any investor always has to be aware of their investing surroundings. And that comes to, you know, that relates to the sentiment, valuations, the rates market, because we know how intertwined the equities are with rates and monetary policy and so on. And we just have to be just aware of our investing surroundings and understand that investing is not always so easy.
Yeah, so let's talk in 2 more weeks, see where we are then, and go from there.
Sounds good. Thank you, Ed.
Thanks again.